Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education is your weekly guide to all matters related to teaching and learning from an Irish perspective. An archive of podcasts of close to 400 previous episodes of Inside Education can be accessed by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. This week on the programme, we discuss holistic education. To do this, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor John P. Miller from the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. John P., or Jack Miller, is the author of The Holistic Curriculum, which was first published in 1988, has been translated into Japanese and Chinese, and the third edition of which has just been published in April 2019. He also co-edited the International Handbook of Holistic Education, which Routledge published this year. When I met up with John P. Miller, I began our conversation by asking him, what is holistic education?
Basically, it's education of the whole person, the body, the mind, and the spirit, and seeing the human being in that wholeness. It's also a big part of holistic education is seeing how things are connected. And we know that, and this comes from ecology and our understanding of nature, how everything is interdependent. So in terms of trying to set up any kind of education, our education reflect that interdependence. So there should be a lot of focus on connections and interdependence. So those are the two main things, the whole person and interdependence.
So when you talk about the whole person, that sounds very natural, and it sounds like all education should be holistic. So why isn't it?
It's a mystery, because there is a long tradition of talking about the whole person from different cultures, but particularly in the 20th century, we began to move to basically an economic model of education. And again, it's even gotten worse in the 21st century with so much focus on educating for the workplace. So what happens then is it becomes very much about skills and the intellect. And again, the body and the spirit are basically ignored. So it's just been a historical thing. And again, most governments, most ministry of education have followed that kind of mantra of preparing people for the workplace.
So when you say that things seem to have got worse in the 20th century, was education ever holistic in the past?
Well, you could look at like Plato's Academy, I think, was actually holistic, because he actually had people doing various like contemplative practices. There was also a university in India called Nalanda University, ancient Buddhist university, and I visited the ruins, and you could see they had places for people to meditate, and apparently they did different yoga and that kind of thing there. And then you had, like, I'm very interested in the American Transcendentalists, and Emerson and Thoreau and Elizabeth Peabody, those people, they actually talked about a holistic model of education. And Thoreau, and of course Elizabeth, they actually taught, and they tried to teach in a holistic way. So there are these little kind of points of light that you can find historically.
In terms of the intellectual sources then, you've mentioned Plato, Thoreau, Peabody. Who else would be the people that you would look to in terms of the intellectual source of this idea for education?
Okay, so there are many. One, of course, is Indigenous education. Indigenous, of course, they saw the universe is interconnected, and so all the education was to educate the young person to see that. And of course, it was very, very experiential, so they had things like the Vision Quest. You also had the period around when the Buddha and Socrates, this period before about 500 BC, 300 to 500 BC, there was a period there where you had these outstanding teachers who taught, again, the importance of things like compassion, and they, in a sense, were models. Then you can go up to like the 18th century, and then you have Rousseau. Again, another person is Tolstoy. Like, Tolstoy was very interested in education, actually had his own school on his estate, and he actually taught at that school, and it was a free school. It was for the peasants' children, and they would come and go as they liked. They didn't have to stay for the lessons if they wanted to. And in fact, it was so radical that once when he was away, the government came in and shut it down. It was like, you know, and he also, people don't even realize, he also developed a reader for in Russian that it was, again, it was more like an experiential approach to reading rather than just phonics, right? So, and of course, today we have Montessori and we have Waldorf education, which are definitely, they're not perfect. You know, no model is perfect, but they definitely have a vision of the whole child. And you can find others as well, Reggio Emilia, and there are many Krishnamurti's, you know, schools. So we do have models. Like, I really believe the government should be trying to take the best ideas of Montessori and Waldorf and trying to bring them into schools, and very, very few people have tried to do that.
When you mention indigenous people and looking to them as a source, that raises a question for me. Is holistic education compatible with mass education?
To do it well, probably not. So I think what you have to try to do is develop like points of light, have various schools around the world, and even within school boards. So here in Toronto, there's a school called the Equinox Holistic School. They took my book, The Holistic Curriculum, and used that as a foundation for developing their curriculum. It's in its 10th year now. And I believe they've actually been able to develop a holistic curriculum in a public school, right? Of course, it's an alternative school. And again, you can find other examples of this, but they're rare. It's true that they're rare. Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the Equinox Holistic Alternative School? How is it organized and who attends it? Things like that.
Yeah, it's an elementary school starting from junior kindergarten to grade 8. And it's in its 10th year. And they have an amazing group of teachers who helped found the school. And that core group of teachers has been there for 10 years. And again, the whole idea of my book, The Holistic Curriculum, is about a connected curriculum. So they use, and I've talked about 6 connections. Some of the connections are connection to the earth, connection to community, connection to different forms of thinking, connections between subjects. So they took these connections and use it as kind of a frame for like developing their curriculum. They gave every new teacher a copy of the holistic curriculum, and it was kind of the guide for the school. And I would say one of the biggest focus of the school is the earth connection. There's a lot of focus on being in nature. Even though it's in East End of Toronto, there are places they can go to, like ravines and a lot of nice places where the students can observe and inquire into nature. So that's been a big part of the curriculum. It's so popular that they have a big waiting list of parents who want to get their kids into this school. So they have, like, I think, well over 80 parents who are on this waiting list, want to get their kids in the school. Why doesn't the school board, you know, have more schools like this if there's so much interest in it? And I did a study of the school in 2015 when I interviewed almost all the teachers, and I interviewed 9 parents and 9 children, and came up, I think, with some really positive, like, findings about the school. Yeah.
And do they teach subjects like, you know, language arts and mathematics? And
yeah, they do. They have to meet the you know, the guidelines of the Ministry of Ontario, but they try to do it with like holistic learning things. So they try to integrate subjects. And so if you're studying math, they might have some just teaching math as a separate subject, but they'd also have activities that are more integrated where you might do measurement or other activities, math activities that are linked in with other subjects. They definitely have to meet the requirements. The only thing they don't have to do is that we in Ontario have like these standardized tests that are given at grade 3, 6, and 10. And the parents can opt out of that if they want. So several parents who have their kids in that school, they choose not to have their kids take those tests. So that's different than sort of the normal like public school, yeah.
Do they use textbooks?
I think in areas like math they do, but I don't think they use many textbooks. They try to get away from that. And at least one teacher, at one time they had 2 teachers that came from Waldorf education which don't use textbooks. So that's been an influence in the school. So textbooks are used, but at a minimum.
And What would the experience of holistic education be like for a child in general?
It should be a good experience. Like I think the main criteria for, particularly for an elementary or young children, is that the students really look forward to going to school and being in a loving community, being in a community where they know that they're cared for, but also to be in an environment where they're learning and learning in a very engaged way, not in a very like, you know, we read so much about in some schools that kids filling out worksheets and just doing kind of repetitive tasks that are not engaging and can actually turn the child off from education in the school. It should really engage them to want to learn, but also overall it should help them develop a good sense of who they are as a person. That's probably the most. And I interviewed some of the students that were then in high school, and one of the things that they almost all said to me is that the school helped them develop a solid sense of who they were. So they were much better to take on life with that kind of sense than if you don't have that sense.
Would students have much autonomy in holistic education?
That can vary. There's no one perfect model for holistic education. Like if you look at Waldorf education, it's pretty structured. There's not a lot of autonomy or choice for students because Steiner felt that if you give too much choice to children, that's confusing for them, particularly for young children, that they need. At the other extreme, you have schools based on Summerhill, the English, where basically kids, and I mentioned like the Tolstoy model, which is similar, kids can choose whether they want to go to class or not. That kind of environment is appropriate for a very creative, self-directed like child who would feel confined in kind of a Waldorf, and Montessori's in between, right? Like there is more individual, like you don't see in Montessori, where you go into a Waldorf classroom and they're sitting there in rows, right? But if you go into a Montessori classroom, there might be one student working alone or two or three students working together, so that you see the difference. But all of them, they're trying to educate the whole child in their own way and trying to, in a sense, accommodate the child for where they are. And so that's what I would say.
Okay, so autonomy is not a defining feature.
I wouldn't say it's a defining feature. Now, obviously, as they get older, certainly by adolescence, autonomy should be respected. So I'm talking about the young child up to like grade 6. Definitely, though, by maybe even an intermediate level. Starting in adolescence, they definitely should have some autonomy.
And if you were recruiting a teacher to teach in a holistic school, or if you were recruiting a teacher to teach in a holistic way, what kind of qualities would you be looking for? What kind of preparation would they need?
Well, first of all, you try to get people that are healthy, that they have a sense of themselves. You know, Parker Palmer says, we teach who we are. And he talked about the divided and the undivided self. And, you know, the divided self is when you are confused about your values, and the undivided self is when you have a strong sense of your values and you're able to, as much as possible within an institution, to convey those values. That's the main thing. Like in terms of pedagogy, they can always learn a technique. It's so much more important. And if you like ask people like what teachers had a big effect on them, it wasn't so much their methods, it was who they were as a person. And so that's what you really look for.
If we take any subject, you know, take history, but it could be any subject, what is the difference between teaching a subject holistically and teaching it conventionally?
Again, it's trying to find something in that subject that the student can connect to, and not just trying to give them information that they're to absorb. And I would say certainly one of the things that you try to do in all these stuff is develop this child's curiosity, to make them curious about the subject so that they want to learn more. So they're not this like passive receptor. So that's the challenge of the teacher, is to find something in the subject that they're teaching that students will find interesting. And it doesn't mean that every like moment you're trying to like find something interesting for the child, but you really are making an effort to do that, so they're not this like passive receptor.
So what would planning be like then for this kind of teaching from the teacher's point of view?
First of all, you have to have some understanding of the subject. But you certainly, like today in the age of Google and everything, we don't have to like know everything about a subject, right? Because, so the one of the things you would plan to do is to try to develop an interesting set of questions or topics that would engage the student. So this James Bean, he's done a lot of work in integrated curriculum. His idea is that the teacher, with the students, identify different questions that they're interested in. And he divides the questions into personal questions and more like societal questions. You take these questions and then you try to, out of those questions, identify some themes that the students would be interested in. And he argues that that way you can, you know, the kids will really be engaged because you started it from the very beginning with some of their interests.
I'm not familiar with James Bean's work. Can you say a little bit about him?
He'd wrote a book, I think it's called Integrated Curriculum. And he's been working in the field. I think he might be retired now. The other person is Susan Drake, who is a professor at Brock University here. And she's written like at least three books in integrated curriculum. And she has developed kind of a model for, again, trying to meet the government guidelines, but trying to do it through integrated curriculum. Yeah, so there's another person that you know is worth really reading.
And what's the relationship between holistic education and wisdom?
I think I think there's like five or six main aims of holistic education. I think one of them certainly is the development of wisdom and compassion. So going back to what I said right at the beginning, if you see how things are interconnected, that really to me is the beginning of wisdom. If you see things as just unrelated, unconnected, then you're not seeing basically how things are. So if children were immersed in a curriculum or in an education setting where that was so predominant, so they saw that how things were always in relationship and that they are in relationship, then they have a healthy sense of how things actually are. And out of that can come wisdom. So that's really, I think, one of the most important goals in holistic ed.
And if you're working with future teachers, how do you help them to start seeing those kinds of connections themselves?
So one of the things that I do, I mean, there's many, many ways, right? First of all, you introduce the idea of connectedness and the kind of the philosophical and ecological roots of that. But I also believe that there's certain like different spiritual practices. We don't have to call them even spiritual. There are practices that work on seeing how things are interconnected. So in my courses, two of my courses since 1988, I've asked people to do meditation. Because meditation is actually seeing how your inner life is connected to your outer life, right? So if you can have particularly some kind of experiential, if you can have actually the experience of connectedness with yourself, then that's how you can like bring it into, of course it's controversial to, you know, ask people to do this, but I've just had such success doing it. And I think it's just, what I would say is you would give the student, teacher, educator, you give them a choice of what kinds of practices they would like to do that would help in this way. So we just need to move. I mean, so much teacher education is just head learning. They're not learning these things that I'm talking about. So they need to have experiences that can allow that to happen. And I just feel that our teacher education is failing in that way.
And one of the practices you mentioned there is meditation. What other practices come to mind?
What I do believe is that in teacher education, students should have a choice of the kind of practice they would like to do. So one might be meditation, one might be some kind of body work, so like Tai Chi or Qigong or yoga, and really engage in that practice so that they can, again, hopefully have some experience of connectedness.
We hear a lot in education about reflection.
Yeah.
You also talk about contemplation. What do you see as the difference between reflection and contemplation?
Contemplation is having a direct experience with something. Sometimes the experience can be so direct that you actually feel you're part of what you're observing, right? That you have this deep sense of connection. So the reflection is after you've had that experience, you begin to think about what you've experienced. So you look for observations that have happened from that experience. So that they need to go together. So often, though, we start the reflection without having a direct experience. So just then it becomes, again, just a head thing. But if you've had some kind of embodied, and that's another kind of way of talking about contemplation, some kind of embodied experience where something, again, becomes part of you, like you feel it in your like bones, maybe not necessarily that deep, but you feel something has happened to you. You've been moved in some way. And then the reflection becomes much more meaningful. It's not just this analysis that's divorced from experience. They're both really important.
And how do you put yourself in a space where you are contemplating or contemplative?
Yeah, okay. Well, there's two forms of, I think. One is like structured. So that is thing like meditation and different awareness, what we call awareness training. So again, certain body works, Tai Chi works on developing awareness. Well, that's how it can be practiced. But we also, there's spontaneous contemplation. We have moments where we have this feeling of sometimes of awe and wonder, just again, like being in nature. So we need to support, particularly for the child, like nourishing those experiences.
Or even recognizing them.
Yeah, right. But that's where the meditation comes in, because you're practicing attention and awareness, right? That's what it's all about. And there's this whole thing called mindfulness, and mindfulness is being present in the moment as much as possible without distraction.
And mindfulness is a part of holistic education.
It's definitely part of holistic education. The only trouble now is that there's a huge mindfulness movement, which doesn't necessarily include holistic education. Sometimes it's used as a technique, and we know that it's effective in helping people become calmer, and there's, you know, there's certain evidence how it's helpful in different ways. Holistic education wants to see it as part of this, like developing the whole person.
How do you see the difference between religious education and spirituality education?
Okay, yeah. So religious education is learning about different religions, their history, and I think really looking at their practices, you can look in the religions and how they're similar and how they're different. And some people argue that within a religion, you at the one end you have like fundamentalism, and at the other end you have like mysticism, and you can find that in most religions. So the mystical Christian has a lot of similarity with the mystical Buddhist. I think studying the religion, I think, is very important. I really believe, because we have so much misunderstanding about religion today, and a lot of hatred is rising out of misunderstanding religion. So spiritual, like learning about spirituality, they're not necessarily totally divorced. Within the religion, you have spiritual practices. Most religions have some kind of contemplation practice, and that's usually at more of the mystical end of the religion. At the fundamental end, it's always about literal interpretation of text. And again, fundamentalism is about some kind of authority that you have to believe in. Whereas at the other end, it's more about your personal experience and your direct experience of the divine. And spirituality is more at that end. It's because it's more about one's personal encounter with the mystery of life. So in terms of spirituality, it would focus more on practices. So I've had a course called Spirituality and Education. And I give them a broad range of practices to do, not just meditation, but like a gratitude journal or generosity practice or things like that. So they have some kind of experiential thing. So again, the religious education is more about knowledge of the religions, and the spirituality would be more about some kind of a practice.
And when you talk about the course Spirituality and Education, what kind of people are you drawing on in that course?
One of the persons that's been very influential to me is Thomas More. He wrote a book in the late 90s called Care of the Soul. He's one of the people that really introduced this notion of soul in a more like broad kind of inclusive way, not in a religious way. Because when you talk about people having a soulful experience, they understand that. It's like something that's deep happens within you. So, you know, my book, Education and Soul, looks at what I call the curriculum, the many different ways you can nurture the soul. As one is, again, through nature, having kids having a lot of experiences in nature. But I've also talked about a curriculum for the inner life, which is, again, thing like journal writing and storytelling and these kinds of things which touch the inner life of the child. And, of course, there are many other people, too, that, again, Parker Palmer and Rachel Kessler is another person. She wrote a book about the soul. And again, she'd worked a lot at this high school level, so she had a lot of good ideas about how kids at that level, you can touch things that can help them awaken their soul or nourish their soul.
And what is spiritual intelligence?
I think spiritual intelligence is actually wisdom. I think there's a bit of a problem with the term from my point of view. I think intelligence is important. And, you know, we have all kinds of intelligence. You know, this comes from
Howard Gardner,
right? He talked about different kinds of intelligences. And so some people picked up on that idea and developed also the term emotional intelligence and spiritual intelligence. So I think that it's helpful in a way that you do need to have some kind of intelligence when it comes to spirituality. We need to be able to assess what is based, you know, in reality and what is like fantasy. And we still need to use evidence to support our understanding. But of course, in spirituality, there's not always evidence. So that's where I think the spiritual intelligence comes in. We need to be able to discriminate, but we can't stop there, right? I think the problem is that, see, a lot of in spirituality, there's this realm beyond words. So even though the intelligence is important, we also have to have an openness to what we call the mystery of life.
And that was John P. Miller from the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you more from my interview with John P. Miller about holistic education on next week's programme. In the meantime, you can listen back to this or hundreds of previous episodes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookstores or it can be ordered at your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.